Well, good morning. We live in a time where we have more ability to choose than at any other time in human history. We have more options to choose from. And the average large-scale grocery store, here, put yourself in yours. Whatever grocery store you normally go to, okay, in your mind's eye, kind of picture yourself walking in, all right? Now, walk over to the toothpaste section. There on the average grocery store has 40 options for toothpaste. Why do we need 40 options for toothpaste? All right, now, so leave the toothpaste aisle in your mind and walk over to the cereal aisle. All right. Why do we need, on average, 285 options for cereal in your average large-scale grocery store? The thing is, like, we have more ability to choose across all areas of life. It's not just grocery stores. It's not just stuff and items like that. But in our relationships, like, we have more ability to connect with more people and more types of people than we ever have before. And the flip side of that is we can be more specific with who we want to connect with than we ever have before. And you would think, like, man, like, if I'm looking, like, let's say I'm looking, I'm on the prowl, I'm looking for someone to date, maybe to marry, you know, if that's the direction I'm going, I'm already happily married. But let's say in this hypothetical, let's say I'm looking for someone, I'm on a date, and then maybe marry one day. I can be very, very specific, not just on the person, but the type of person. Like, you think about it, like, all the dating services and social media. Like, if I'm looking for a very specific person, I can find that person. And so you're like, man, like, we have more choices than we ever have before. Like, it's not just the person, like, the type of people I'm looking for. There are all kinds of dating services specific to types of people. You know, you can go on a dating service, an online website, and meet and date only people who are gluten-free. Did you know that? Man, I just want to meet someone to share my life with and take down bread together. Like, that's... Like, we can be very, very specific in all areas of life. We have more ability to choose than ever before. Did you know that there are website dating services only for ugly people? I mean, when you go to that website for the first time, you're just like, well, the writing's on the wall. I can't find anyone anywhere else. I'll go to the ugly people website. Okay. Okay, there are dating websites for people. It's called Personals, and it's only for people who love cats. I feel like if we can have, like, a Personals convention of all the people on the website, and we can just, like, lock the door and throw the key away. I mean, who's mad about this? No one. No one is mad about this. There, okay, my favorite one. By the way, my favorite, like, you can be very specific in who you choose to be with, the type of people you choose to spend your time with. There is an Amish-only dating website, which I felt like before reading that, I knew what Amish meant, but apparently I don't, because I didn't know that Amish people had things like websites specifically for them. I thought the whole point was that they don't have websites. I don't know what that word means anymore. That word has changed because it means something very, very different. Also, what I really want to see is someone, when they get matched with someone, how they respond. Like, I wish I could be a fly on the wall when someone's like, ooh, I just matched with Bartholomew Timotheus. Ooh, look, girl, look. I gave him 4 out of 5 barns. You see the beard on this guy? Ooh. I had no idea that Amish has changed so much since I last knew what that meant. But in all areas of life, like, we have more ability to choose than we ever have before. And you would think that with our ability to choose, you know, with be so specific with the things that we want and we don't want, the people we want to be around, the people we don't want to be around, and everything from our toothpaste to our cereal, like, we would be more content than we ever have before. But actually, an author named Barry Schwartz wrote a book called The Paradox of Choice. And in it, he talks about how the more choices we have, the harder it is to make the right choice, and that we're constantly in this tension between, all right, I had a hard time choosing, and I chose this, but then I spend the rest of my time thinking about what would have happened if I had not chosen this, but I had chosen one of the other options. In his book, one quote from his book, he says this, in Barry Schwartz, Paradox of Choice, he says, autonomy and freedom of choice are critical to our well-being. And choice is critical to freedom and autonomy. Nonetheless, though modern Americans have more choice than any group of people ever has before, and thus presumably more freedom and autonomy, but we don't seem to be benefiting from it psychologically. See, what you have is you have the ability to make more choices in more areas of life than you ever have before. So theoretically, we are more free. We have more options. We have more choices. We have more choices to make choices from. We have more options. And so we are at our freest that we've ever been. And it's because we can choose down to the umpteenth degree of what do I want over here and what do I want over here and what do I want over here, then we should be completely content with all of our choices. But what he says and what I think we've found to be true in all of our lives individually is that we are not content. We are far from it. Actually, the same thing that gives us such choice in so many areas of life, the internet, is the exact same thing that proves how discontent we actually are. In a recent survey of thousands of Facebook users, it says that 44% of Facebook users have used Facebook for an emotional affair, which means we are not content with our choices. 17% of Facebook users, not the married ones, not 17% of the people who've had affairs, but 17% of Facebook users say they used Facebook as a way of connecting to people for affairs. So we have more choices than we've ever had before, and yet we are at the same time, paradoxically, less content than we've ever been before. We've always been discontent. If we have more choices, we're discontent. If we have less choices, we're discontent. Throughout our life, it feels like at times our souls, our spirits are like bottomless buckets, and we try and fill them up, and it comes right out the bottom, and at no point is our soul full. Like our souls feel like these bottomless buckets we're constantly trying to fill, and they never fill up. And it's because God made us to be discontent, to look around what we're doing, what we're investing our life in. And if it's anything but him, to live with such deep senses of discontent. And this is the first half of my, if you remember one thing today, one phrase, one big idea, this is the first half of it, is that you will be discontent for your entire life. You have very little choice in the matter. And that this is the way that God designed us. God designed us to be discontent. One author, Stephen Altrogi, a pastor and author, says this. He says, we won't be satisfied when we get what we want because God loves us and wants us to find our satisfaction in him. He won't allow us to be satisfied. To believe that we'll be happy when we get what we want is a lie. And it's fascinating to me that we will live our entire lives discontent with some like the low-level rumbling, a hum of discontent in the back of our minds, in the back of our hearts, our entire lives. It's frustrating. Is it maybe a little bit demoralizing? Man, can't there be some sort of like magic pill or like some silver bullet that the Bible can give us and we'll be content, we'll be blissfully content the rest of our lives? Why is it that we live with this sort of like low-level rumble of discontent our entire lives? It doesn't matter how many choices we have, how many things we have to choose from, we are discontent. At first glance, when you read this through this passage that we're going to today, it feels like Paul is saying the opposite. See, we're in the series called Functional Faith. It's about how faith actually functions in the real world. And in the real world, like we struggle and we wrestle with things like discontent. And as you first begin to read this verse in Philippians 4:11, it feels like Paul is saying the opposite. He's saying that he has found contentment. He has found complete and perfect centered contentment, and he never feels discontent ever again. And in verse 11, it says this. It says, I have learned how to be content with whatever I have. And you're like, man, I don't know what Paul has, but I want what he has. Like, just you and me here. I live with discontentment. I live wanting things. I see things and I covet them and I want them. Like I don't have what Paul has. He says, I have learned to be content with whatever I have. The thing is though, what Paul says here, content, the actual original word is this word autarkis. You'll see it here in the screen. Content, autarkis. And autarkis is from the same root as automobile or autonomous. And autarkis means self-sufficient, self-empowered, self-reliant. And autarkis here, what did he say? He said, I have learned in all areas of life to be autarkis. Now, at first glance, this seems to be very, very different than what he has been saying. You see, autarkis was the central value or tenet of the dominant philosophy of Paul's day. That philosophy is called Stoicism. And when Paul was around, the dominant philosophy was called Stoicism. And this was Stoicism. If you've never known someone who is Stoic, like their personality is Stoic, this is someone who never gets too high or never gets too low. They're never too excited. They're never disappointed. And in Paul's day, the Stoic philosophy is one that at all times you disconnect from life, you don't love stuff, you don't love people, and through autarkis, through your self-sufficiency, through your self-reliance, you disconnect from life and things and stuff and people. So that if someone breaks into your home and they steal your stuff, the Stoic would say, I'm disconnected from my stuff. I don't care. You've stolen my stuff. That's fine. I don't care. I don't love it. And if someone that you're, in your family passes away, the Stoic would say, I disconnect from that person. I'm not emotionally involved with that person. Like, I am Stoic. I don't get too high. I don't get too low. Philosophically, I don't have control over my life. So if that person passes away, I'm not involved. I don't get emotionally entangled with people and stuff. And the Stoic would say, that's how you gain contentment, by not being connected to anyone or anything ever. Actually, one of the dominant Stoic philosophers of Paul's day was this guy named Epictetus. And he says this. He says, all external events, this is a kind of like outlining Stoic philosophy. All external events are beyond our control. We should accept calmly and dispassionately whatever happens. However, individuals are responsible for their own actions, which they can examine and control through rigorous autarkis or self-discipline. And so Paul says this funny thing. He aligns himself at first glance with the dominant philosophy of his day, which feels like it goes counter and against what he had been saying. You see, we've been in this passage, Philippians 4, for a few weeks now, and he constantly talks about reliance on Jesus and life lived towards Jesus, and that's when you have joy, and that's when you live with sweet equity, and that's when you don't worry, and that's when you attach your thoughts to God's goodness and who he says you are. And if you do this, then you'll find things like joy and then here he says, you live by God, you live by Jesus, live the way Jesus called you to. I have found autarkis. I have found autonomy, self-sufficiency. I have found Stoic philosophy. It's like this weird sort of like switch. He turns 180 degrees around. But we have to keep reading. So we read in the next verse. First thing he says is, I have found the ability to be content. And then Philippians 4:12, the next verse, he has three more I statements. It seems very sort of like Paul-centric at this point. I have found the secret to contentment. I know how to live on almost nothing or with everything. I have learned the secret of living in every situation, whether it is with a full stomach or empty, with plenty or with little. And so he has in these first two verses of Philippians 4, 11 and 12, four I statements. I know what it means to live content because I have done this through self-sufficiency. I know how to live on almost nothing or with everything. I have learned the secret of living in every situation. I. If you're like me, when you're reading this, you're like, man, Paul, what are you doing? It's a completely different sort of like, it's so off-brand for what he's been saying. But even in these I statements, you're sort of like challenged. You're like, all right, Paul, like, are these statements true? Like, have you really gone through all of this? 2 Corinthians 11, chapter 24, verse 24 and 25 says this. This is Paul talking about the same things he's been saying. He said, I've gone through these terrible things and I've still been content. I've gone through these wonderful things. I've gone through these terrible things. And in 2 Corinthians, he begins to outline some of the things he's gone through. He says, five different times the Jewish leaders gave me 39 lashes. He's been beaten with a whip five times. Three times I have been beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. That means something very different. you know, I was really hurting. They threw rocks at him to try and kill him. Three times I was shipwrecked. Well, oddly enough, if you're with Paul and you've shipwrecked twice, and he's like, hey, man, do you want to go on a boat ride? No, I don't. Like, I feel like after two shipwrecks, you're going to stay away from boats. Not Paul. Three times I was shipwrecked. Once I spent a whole night and day adrift at sea. And Paul's going through like, and there's verses before this and verses after this. He's talking about the terrible things he's lived through and gives context for what he says in Philippians 4, verse 12. When he says, I've gone through good things. I've gone through bad. I've gone through pain. I've gone through luxury. And you have, and he begins to unpack how he's been content and how he's been good in all of these different ways. And he, you see here, like, he's gone through these difficult, painful things. And he's, but they also, when he's this letter is to the church at Philippi. And when he first started this church at Philippi, when he first walked in, the first person he met was this person named Lydia. And Lydia was this wildly wealthy person. She was this person in the fashion industry. She was a seller of purple dye. And this Lydia person would have been one of the wealthiest people around. And when Paul moved to Philippi, he lived with this Lydia person. And so when he lived with Lydia, he would have had the best food and the most comfortable housing with the most comfortable surroundings. It would have been servants in Lydia's home. And this is, and people who at the church of Philippi, who he's writing this letter to, they would have known that. And so they know that Paul has seen the best of the best. And they know that Paul has seen the worst situations, the most painful situations, time when people abused him and beat him, and he was shipwrecked. And he has genuinely, as the verse says, lived through the best and the worst of times. But then the question becomes, why? If Paul has lived all of these crazy experiences, why? Why would he do that? Why would he go through all of that? And then you realize that this passage, this Philippians 4 passage, he's not done yet. And he's going to take a switch. His message, his brand, he's going to switch back to what he normally would say. And the next verse in Philippians 4, this is one of the most wrongly quoted, wrongly applied, interpreted verses in the entire Bible. In Philippians 4:13, it says this. It's a fifth I statement. It says, I have learned how to be content with any situation I am in. I've gone through good stuff. I've gone through bad stuff. I've had more than enough. I've had an empty stomach. And he says this, for I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. And you realize this whole time, what Paul was doing is Paul was using the verbiage and philosophy of his day so that he was engaging culture in the way that culture was currently functioning and flowing through life. And he was saying, I know what culture is saying. I know what you guys believe. And I know that it's this autarkus, it's this self-sufficiency, it's this self-reliance. But honestly, that's not going to get you to contentment. You can't disconnect yourself to contentment. You can't self-reliance yourself. You can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps and then one day live this fully content life. It's not how the human experience functions. You can't do it that way. I've gone through good stuff. I've gone through bad stuff. I've had luxurious times. I've had an empty stomach. I've lived every experience. When I've been able to experience contentment, it is through Christ who has given me strength. Not my own strength, not self-sufficiency, not self-reliance. It is from him, for him, through him, and by him. But then you step back and you look at this, you look what he said, and you pull back from it a little bit, and you pull back not just what these couple of words and these couple of verses says, but you look at the way that he's lived his life, what he was doing when he was shipwrecked, what he was doing when he was beaten, what he was doing when he was whipped. And you realize this is not someone whose life is marked by contentment at all. And look at Philippians 3:10, the previous chapter. You see, in Philippians 3:10, he says this, I want to know Christ and experience the mighty power that raised him from the dead. I want to suffer with him, sharing in his death. He says his life is about him understanding, aligning with, growing in knowledge and likeness of Jesus. That is the sum total of his life. He desperately wants to be more like Christ, to know Christ better. This does not sound like someone who is content. Or in Romans, it says this. In Romans chapter 9, it says this. In Romans 9, 2, 3, it says, my heart is filled with bitter sorrow and unending grief. This is the same guy, Paul. For my people, my Jewish brothers and sisters, I would be willing to be forever cursed, cut off from Christ, if that would save them. So this guy who originally was saying, I have learned contentment. When you pull back from it, this is someone whose life is far from content. This is someone who lives with a wildfire, burning desire for Jesus. And not just for himself personally, but for other people, his brothers and sisters, the people he meets. He travels all over the world, not because he wants to see the world, because there are people over there far away who don't know Jesus. It doesn't matter what it costs, doesn't matter what it takes, he's going to make sure that those people have heard the name of Jesus. Oh, and there's people over there. yes, I've shipwrecked twice, but you know what? I'm going to go on another boat because those people over there, they need Jesus just as much as those people did and as much as I do. And this is someone who starts out, I know what it means to be content. But then when you pull back from this original message, this is not someone who is content. This is someone with a burning desire, an insatiable desire for more of Jesus. And you realize what I said earlier, which is you will be discontent your entire life. You will either be discontent for the things of God, or you'll be discontent for the things of this world. And there's a one-to-one relationship between those two things. When Paul here was saying, I have learned the secret to being content, he's speaking about things in the world that he can see because he's content. He doesn't need that stuff. He can be uncomfortable. He can be with an empty stomach. He can be with a full stomach. He can be beaten. He can be shipwrecked because he doesn't need that stuff. It's not about disconnection. It's about connection. Connection to Jesus and connection to who Jesus has made him to be. And so that other people can feel that same connection to Jesus. In your life, you will be discontent for your entire life. The only choice you have is whether or not you're discontent for the things of this world or the things of God. Paul was someone who had found contentment because he was so discontent for the things of God. He lived with this burning, holy discontent. He desperately wanted to know Jesus and for more people to know Jesus. And I feel like when you come to faith, when you begin to walk with Jesus, if you're someone who has walked with Jesus for a while, if you're a person of faith, think back when you first met Jesus. Didn't you walk with this burning intensity, this discontent for, man, I just discovered Jesus and I need everyone else to discover Jesus too. And over time, that holy discontent, it begins to fade because we medicate that discontentment with pursuing discontentment of things that we see and nice things and the newest model and this and that. Your entire life, you'll be discontent. You'll either be discontent for the things of God, you'll be discontent for the things of this world. Contentment isn't about disconnection, like the Stoics would say. It's about a deep connection to who Jesus is. There's this cartoon character who predates me. His name is Popeye. Popeye was a sailor man. Popeye is what you call anatomically unlikely. And that was his girlfriend next to him, Olive Oil, who also is what you'd call anatomically unlikely, but in very different ways. And Popeye, the sailor man, he was this guy who he was patient. Like this bad guy Bluto, he would pick on him and bully him, and it wouldn't bother him. He wouldn't get violent. He wouldn't respond in the same way. He was very patient, and he would, I'm not gonna meet you there, Bluto. I'm not gonna fight back, until Bluto did something to Olive Oil, the love of his life. And then Popeye would say something. Well, you can see it for yourself.
That's all I can stand. I can't stand no more.
That's right. That's it. Paul, when Popeye said those words, that's all I can stand. I can't stand no more. This is when Bluto was being unkind or endangering Olive Oil. And Popeye would change. He would take the spinach out and he would open up that can of spinach. And I don't know what you thought I was going to say. He would open that can of spinach and he would eat it, and it would go all to his biceps, and he would go and he would beat up Bluto and he would defend Olive Oil and he would save the day. But inevitably in the Popeye cartoon, what he would start with is, that's all I can stand. I can't stand no more. And I ask you, like Popeye, at what point have you had all you can stand? You can't stand no more. What is it you can't stand in life? What is it that when you see it, it generates this burning, like, I need to make a change here. I need to be part of the solution here. I can't just stand idly by and watch this happen any longer. What can't you stand? And if you don't have an answer to that, chances are you're medicating your holy discontent with a discontent for the things that you see and the things that you want and the things you desire and the nicer model. What can't you stand? You will spend your entire life discontent, either for the things of God or the things of this world. So what if? What if you lived with a gospel-centered sense of urgency? If your heart was a firestorm for the things that burn in the heart of God? What if you let go of pride and posturing and ego-driven choices and lived with abandon for what God wanted from you? What if you said yes to the Spirit? Now, God, what are you asking from me? Whatever it is, yes, my answer is yes. Now tell me what you want me to do. But what if you defined we not as us versus them or we versus you people, but what if we viewed we like Jesus views we when he said, for God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever, I mean, there's so much we and you, we versus you people in the church and outside of the church. What if we used we like Jesus used we? What can't you stand? What do you have a burning, holy discontent for in your heart? Where will you invest your life? What about your world is deeply, desperately broken, but you hope, you have hope in your heart that that will one day change? If hope dies in the heart of the Jesus follower, hope is officially dead. What do you hope for? What do you hope will change? What can't you stand? See, I don't believe, like Paul said, that I can do everything through Christ who strengthens me. I don't. I do believe we, as a community, can do everything through Christ who gives us strength. I don't just want to be a pastor. I want to be a man who pastors a church with a wild, unmatched, holy discontent for the things of God. I want to have a broken heart for the things that breaks God's heart. We are the community. We went through a time of transition, years of transition, and we have our feet under us now. The boat is not quite as rocky. We're a bit more stable. We can use that stability to cultivate comfort. We could. And we could get really comfortable. Or we as a community could use that stability to cultivate a wild, untamed, wildfire type, holy discontent that burns in the hearts in each and every one of us. And when we see things that are desperately broken, the hope that burns in us would be far stronger than the brokenness in that situation. And we would actually leave these walls and go fix it and change it. Paul, this man who said, I'm content. I don't have wants. I don't have desires. I can be full. I can be empty. I can have a terrible situation. I can be in a lush situation. And I'm content with my surroundings because I'm so desperately discontent for the things that God is doing in this earth. You will be discontent your entire life. You'll either be discontent for the things of this world, or you'll be discontent for the things of God. Which is it you will choose? I choose to be discontent for the things of God. So in a few moments, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pray. And I'm going to pray a terrifying prayer that God makes us wildly discontent for the things of him and wildly content for the things of here. And if that's your prayer, if you want God to wreck you, I don't know, raise a hand, open a palm. Maybe you're not comfortable with that sort of thing. You just open up your spirit to that. This is not just my prayer for me. It's your prayer for you. Man, I want to be wildly content for the things of this world and uncontrollably, unabashedly discontent for the things of God. And let's do it together as a community with this newfound stability that we have. So I'm going to pray. If this is your prayer too, just open your soul to that. Maybe it's a hand, maybe it's an open palm, or maybe it's just internal. Let this not just be my prayer. Let this be your prayer too. God, I see things in our cities and in our relationships and in the marriages, and I can't stand it. I see fatherlessness rampant. I see us versus them rampant. I see a city marked by generational poverty, and it goes generation after generation after generation, and I can't stand it. I see people who come to church week after week and they don't take steps towards you, which is sort of like checking a box, and I can't stand it. God, wreck us. Give us a burning discontent for the things of you. give us a wild, inexplainable contentment for the things of this world. Let us be like Paul, who he can go through painful things. He can be shipwrecked. He can be beaten. And it's okay. He keeps going because it's about you and your name ringing out and it being marked by you and aligning and moving more lockstep with you and having more people all over being more lockstep and aligned with you. Let us be a people, a wild, uncontrollable people wrecked for you. God, this is a terrifying prayer. To make us give us a holy discontent. Let us be a church that is truly for the people who are far from you. Let us be people, a collection of people, and each and every one of us is wrecked for you. Let it not be a thing we do on Sundays. God, I am so grateful you designed us to be discontent. Break us from the way that we medicate this God-given discontentedness with purchasing, with accomplishing, with gaining just a more elevated stance in our community, fueling our own ego. Break us of that. Give us a wild, uncontrollable discontentment for the things of you like Paul had. I mean, he's writing this letter that we've been looking at for the last 4 weeks to this church that he started, that he, when he walked into this town, he had never been there before. And he was just walking in with his love for you. And he started a church. And then he left. And this letter is a letter to this church because he loved these people and they've given themselves to you. And none of that would have happened if he was discontent for the things of this world. So give us that. Wreck us for the things of this world. Wreck us for the way that you see it. Break our hearts for the things that break yours. Set us on fire for the things that are set on fire in your heart. Don't let us keep going with this discontent for the here and the now and the newest model. There's no value in that. Wreck us. In your name. Amen.